I welcome you to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. And right now we're in the book of Big Beginnings. We're in the book of Genesis. And we're talking about that huge, earth-changing, catastrophic event known as the flood of Noah. Now, Noah, of course, did not cause this flood. This flood came about because God saw that the earth was full of nothing but sin and sinful intentions by mankind. Mankind had gone off the rails. Now, he'd been manipulated a little bit in that by the fallen angels, apparently, but it was so bad that God had decided the only resolution was to start fresh in a new earth. And the way that he's going to clean the old earth up is by a flood. And we talked about the mechanisms involved in this. And there's just so much brimming in my head about the actions of the flood that are theorized by creationists that I have a hard time expressing them all appropriately. So I encourage you again today, if you want to know more about the mechanisms and the likely features and results of this worldwide flood that's listed here in the book of Genesis, please go and look at websites where they make that a huge part of their focus. Answers in Genesis. They love to deal with this very topic. In fact, they've got the great big Ark Experience that you can go and really get overdosed on all of the technical things that are tied in with the story of the flood and how our world today is best explained by the actions of the flood. Institute for Creation Research in California, ICR.org is their website, would be another place where they do technical papers describing how the fountains of the great deep more than likely caused big jets of water under high pressure, some of it at steam, shooting up into a vapor canopy. That this is what caused the breakup of this delicate balance in Earth One, and how all of that water vapor collapsed and came down, and how the water stored up underneath the plates of the supercontinent and of the existing ocean, how that water added to the water from above just flooded over the top of that ancient supercontinent. And because it didn't have super high mountains, it drowned the whole thing deep enough that nobody would have been able to survive. But then how after the agitation of those first 40 days, the waters would have begun to let their debris start building up down on the bottom of this water around the world, and how that becomes the sedimentary layers that we're familiar with today, the sedimentary rock. But there's so many details about that you need to go to these other places and learn more about it. For our purposes, we need to stay focused on the reason for the flood. It was because of sin. It was because of the intrusions of the spiteful, hateful actions of at least some of the fallen angels messing around with humanity's genome and perhaps even with the genomes of the different animals of this world. This is what precipitated the need to wipe out that entire first planet and start fresh. And God saved a representative sample of gene stock, human and animal, with which to restart Earth 2, the planet all over again. And so the flood itself takes place over about a year from the time they loaded until they offloaded. And we are now going to focus our attention on the events preparing for the offloading. So verse number 6 of Genesis chapter 8 says, at the end of 40 days. Now, the 40 days that are in mind here are from the time that Noah can start seeing the tops of these rising mountains, because we've got volcanic action that are making new mountains, which are higher than the original mountains. We've also got tectonic action, the sliding of the plates that's forming other mountains like the Himalayas and the Rockies, and all of these mountains that are kind of around the Pacific Rim area. These mountains are pushing up, and Noah can see them on, I think it's day 245 of the flood. And then 40 days after he saw the mountains, he figures, apparently, there should be something reemerging plant-wise out of this new world. One of the things about plants, the reason why they didn't need to take plants on board, is plants can get restarted after floods. Some of them just start from rootstock coming up out of the mud. Others might have been ripped up and they're floating around, and then eventually they settle into a place and they start growing again. And so he apparently understood, maybe God explained this to him, that eventually the vegetation is going to start taking hold in the new world. And so we read in Genesis 8, 6, something that happens on the 284th day of the flood. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the ark, the window of the ark that he had made. So apparently way up high, he's got an access window, probably for this very specific thing. And he sent forth a raven. Now remember, before the flood, ravens were not scavenger birds. They were birds that ate seeds and fruits and things like that. But that apparently is going to start changing now in the new world. So he sent forth a raven, and what does it do? It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. So apparently it did not come back. It just flew all over the place. And it may have, in fact, this is just me speculating here, understand that, it may have found some rotting, stinking corpses and sampled them. And so it's possible that this is the beginning of it being like a scavenger bird. In one of the, I think one of the articles that I found on the Answers in Genesis site once, it was describing how even in a modern period, a completely plant-eating bird, that is a seed eater, a fruit eater, changed into a scavenger bird because its normal diet was not available because of a drought, I think it was. So it switched over to eating carrion that had been dying from the same drought, apparently. And then it kind of just kept that as part of its future dietary choices. And so it quit being just a simple seed eater, fruit eater. It started turning into an omnivore and a scavenger bird. And so something like that might start happening right here with the ravens. Now, verse 8, then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. So that's apparently on the same day. The dove found no place to set her foot. She returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand, took her, and brought her into the ark with him. So he sends out two birds, a raven and a dove. The raven just keeps flying around and around and around and going, doing whatever it's doing, and it doesn't come back. The dove goes out, flies around here and there, but it has no place to land, so it comes home. Verse number 10. He waited another 7 days. So we're now at day number 291. And again, he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. So Noah now knows, at least somewhere nearby, there is a piece of land, not just simply jumping up out of the water, but it actually has vegetation growing on it. One of the olive trees has regenerated enough that it's put on leaves, and so he recognizes it. And this is the reason why, by the way, that we have the image of a dove with an olive branch in its beak. It comes from this Bible passage right here. Now, how it got attached to a piece, I'm not altogether certain. So Noah knew now that the waters had subsided enough from the land that vegetation is coming back. Verse 12, then he waited for another 7 days. So now we're at 298. And he sent forth the dove, and she did not return to him anymore. So now he knows that this dove is like, hey, I'm out here. I don't need to fly back to the ark to have a place to spend the night. So now he knows definitely that life is going to be reestablished on the planet. Verse number 13. In the 601st year, that's of Noah. So he's 601 years old now. It doesn't necessarily mean it's his birthday, but it's the first month and the first day of the month. Now this month here, I believe, is from the Mosaic calendar, the calendar that the Jewish people were given as they left This is the ancient calendar, not the new calendar of the Jewish people. This is the ancient calendar, which is going to be the fall. The beginning of fall is the first month. So in his 601st year, in the first month, on the first day of the month, the waters were dried up off the earth. And so this is the 305th day of the flood. And so Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. So now he's not just simply looking out the window. He now opens some section of the ark. It almost sounds as if he's got some sort of hatch, or he breaks up part of the top of the ark so that they can get up on the top and kind of move around, maybe camp out up there, even sleep out in the weather, to be able to look all around them. Because the ark is on the top of this new mountain range called the Ararat Range. It's pretty high up there. And so he's able to see around and see that an awful lot of the flood water is now gone. And so it's only a matter of time before they can leave the ark and reestablish themselves on planet Earth, on Earth 2. Verse number 15. Then God said to Noah, I skipped verse 14. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried out. And so that is exactly 1 year, according to the ancient calendar system, for the flood, from the day the flood started until they left the ark and went back out into this new world. So it's 361 days, if you will, by the old system. Because of events related to the flood, it would appear as if the perfect 360-day year, that is, the earth going around the sun, lengthens into 365 and almost a quarter days. And the lunar cycle, which had probably been a perfect 30-day count, is now slowed down to 29.49 and a whole bunch of other decimal places after that, days. And so they will now have to adjust to a new calendar system. But weirdly enough, this is something I discovered in my playing around with the ancient calendar system. In the perfect calendar system of the perfect Earth, 12 months of 30 days each would allow the calendar to rotate perfectly around in a 7-year time period, which means that you could have a 7-year calendar and just reuse it. Every day of the 7-year period would fall exactly the same every cycle. With the new world and the change in the length of the year and the change in the length of the month, that is not going to remain in place any longer. However, isn't it intriguing that God gave to the Jewish people a 7-year calendar of work? And I think that might be a little bit of a homage or a little bit of an Easter egg or a little throwback to the pre-flood calendar system. Just my thought. Now, let's get serious about this new earth. Back to Genesis 8:15. Then God said to Noah, "Go out from the ark, get out of the box, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds or flyers and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So it's basically God saying, all right, Noah, the flood is now officially over. Empty the ark, empty the box, and let's have all these animals and all these sons and daughters of yours start repopulating the earth. We're back to square one. Verse 18, so Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, every flying thing, everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. Now, they're in families because the vast majority of them were male-female. Of the animals, in particular, we're thinking here. But remember, there are three pair of humans that are going to be restarting their existence on planet Earth, and they're the ones that are going to start having kids. That's Shem, Ham, Japheth, and their wives. Among the animals, Noah was told to collect up or put into the ark three pairs and a spare of every sacrificial grade animal. Every animal that had already been used previous to the flood for sacrifices for sin and for worship to God. This is the distinction of clean versus unclean, I think, here in the book of Genesis. And I told you at the time that the spare was there for after the flood to be the first sacrifice in this new world. And that's exactly what we see next. Verse 20, then Noah built an altar to he who is, An altar is just a bunch of stones stacked up together to make a relatively flat surface on which you can put sticks, flammable material. And then on top of that, you place the sacrifice. And then you ignite it, or God ignites it, which we have seen happen in Scripture. And it's possible that that happened here the first time. So God took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on this altar. So the three-pair and a spare allowed Noah to start life on earth too with sacrifices of thanksgiving to God. Verse 21, when he who is smelled the pleasing aroma, that's very poetic, it's descriptive, those of us that are carnivores or omnivores and we like a good barbecue, we know, oddly enough, that we like the smell of cooking meat. So Moses and all his people, they live in a time many years after the flood, when sacrificial animals were often given thanksgiving to God, in praise to God, and part of the worship process was to eat the meat of the animals afterwards. And so, since you enjoyed that part of the sacrifice system, when you smell that, it smells delicious. It smells pleasing and good. And so the portrayal here is that God is also happy with this service of sacrifice. And so he said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. So God has already said, this is the last time we're doing a redo of this sort. You know, God cursed the earth when Adam and Eve did the initial sin. And now he's cursed the whole earth with a flood because of the sins of mankind getting so bad. And he says, we're not going that route again. The next time, this whole place is going to be burned up, and I will start fresh completely and entirely. And so Peter makes a big deal out of that, by the way, in his second letter, where he says that the first earth was created out of water and it was destroyed with water. And the current earth and heaven is being reserved for fire, where it will pass away. The elements making up the earth will pass away with a great noise and with great heat, and then will come into existence a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. And so we're all looking forward to that. And so God says, we're not going to do this reuse thing again. It'll all be fresh the next time. And then he points out the reason why it happened is that the intention of man's heart, and we're not talking about gender here, we're talking about humanity, each individual human being. The problem is that from their youth, not from their birth, this is where I take issue with the idea that all of us are born sinners, because I don't believe that. I believe we are born blank slates, that we have the ability of free will to choose to do the right or the wrong. And Scripture seems to uphold that idea. We have that free will choice. The pragmatic reality, sad as it is that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Somewhere in our youth, we get self-centered and focused only on what we want despite the rules, and we cross the line and we sin. And so that is what's being described here, is that God knows that all of us are going to choose the wrong, and that's problematic. Now, he'll always give us an opportunity not to choose the wrong. I emphasize the need for every Christian to memorize 1 Corinthians 10:13, because this is the principle of God being fair with everyone. It says that there is no temptation that has ever overtaken any of us except that which is common to all humanity. And God is faithful. That phrase means God can be trusted. God is faithful in that he will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we are able. So he will never let us be put into a lose-lose situation where we're forced to do the wrong thing. He always gives us a free will choice of doing the right thing. And then the passage goes on, and with that temptation will provide a way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Now, that way of escape might be to die rather than to do, but it's still a way of escape. We can still come out unscathed by that sin. So 1 Corinthians 10:13 is good, solid Bible teaching against the idea that I can't help myself. I was born a sinner, and that's why I sin. No, you were born free of sin, but of your own free will choice, you chose to sin, despite God making it possible for you not to. And thus you became a sinner. And all of us have fallen short of God's glory, and we need salvation. And so here is God saying, I am not going to go through this the same way ever again. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. So God makes the commitment here, and we're about out of time, so we'll talk about it at the beginning of next session as well. God makes the commitment here that he is not going to do a universal destruction and restart in this same way ever again. This is now going to be the place where everything works out.